Happy New Year, and welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. If you're an avid Public Radio Tulsa listener, by now you've heard the Freakonomics radio show that airs on Saturdays at 3 p.m. Hosted by Stephen Dubner, and an outgrowth of the best-selling book he co-authored with University of Chicago economist Steve Levitt, Freakonomics Radio has become a network, offering even more compelling programming for listeners. Its latest offering is called simply Freakonomics MD, and it explores the intersection of economics and healthcare. It started last year, and it's a great listen, full of wonderful interviews, intriguing research, and often counterintuitive findings. The host of the show, Anupam Jena, is both a physician and an economist, and this entry to the podcast world is solid on all fronts. Bapu Jena, as he's known, is the Ruth L. Newhouse Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School, an attending physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he's the host of Freakonomics MD, a podcast you can find anywhere you listen to podcasts. Dr. Bapu Jena is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Anupam Jena, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by just having you tell us an overview of what you think of as what your podcast Freakonomics MD does and is.
Well, the purpose of the podcast is to really figure out the meaning of life. No, it's a show that's about the intersection between economics and medicine. So if you like Freakonomics style thinking, which is basically economics applied to so many things that affect our lives, decisions that we make, decisions that we don't make, things that we see around us and things that we may not even see around us, but with a real focus on medicine. And I think the medical angle is interesting because, you know, health affects all of us. And we see this very clearly now in the COVID-19 pandemic in a way that we haven't before. And there's a lot of interesting questions in health and in medicine that economists have tried to answer. And so the point of the podcast is really to bring that sort of thinking to the world.
And so you, in a way, are almost uniquely qualified to be the host of this podcast because you are, of course, a medical doctor, an internal medicine physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, where you still attend on the wards, but you are also a PhD economist, which, as I learned from, I think, an episode of Freakonomics, where you were a guest, Freakonomics Radio, is a very rare double constellation. There aren't many people like you in the world. I think I heard you estimate maybe not even 24 or something that have both of those kind of terminal degrees. So I guess one question is, how did you ever go down that path? I mean, did you want to be a doctor first or an economist first? Or how does somebody go about doing that? It's a lot of school for sure.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, not that many people are foolish enough to try to do two things that are so different from each other. But, you know, I always wanted to do to be a doctor. So that's the starting point, is I always wanted to see patients. I like medicine, I like biology, and I like the ability to work with people in the capacity of being a doctor. And so I knew that was always going to be on my radar. But I also knew that I liked research, and I wasn't sure what kind of research I wanted to do. And I had studied biology and economics in college. I worked in a basic science lab where, you know, we were working with cells and things like that. And I planned to actually do an MD and a PhD in biology. But when I went to the University of Chicago for my interview for the MD-PhD program, this is back in, I think, 1999, the director of that program said to me, sort of in an offhand way, said, you know, have you thought about doing your PhD in economics instead? You know, we're the University of Chicago, we have a great economics program, and I noticed you had studied economics. And it was probably a throwaway comment that he made, and I was like, yeah, you know what? I actually would be interested in that. And literally that afternoon and then in the morning after, he set up appointments in the economics department at University of Chicago, and I met with people, and I ended up applying to the program like a week later, and I started there in the fall of 2000, so just like 6 or 7 months after I had done the interviews.
I mean, that's just amazing. So almost that throwaway offhand comment, and here it sort of changed your entire destiny. But so interesting that they were able to then accommodate you and get you that meeting in such quick fashion. Were the folks you met in the economics department like very welcoming? Like, oh, you're a medical student? You want to come study economics? Sure. We do that. Well, maybe not all the time, but we do have that every once in a while.
Yeah. I have a kind of a funny story. So I wasn't the first. There was a guy who you probably remember named David Meltzer, who is an MD and also an economist, who had trained at University of Chicago before me, probably like 10 years before me. And he had just come back. So there was a precedent for someone like that, and to train in economics. The other thing that was very nice about the University of Chicago is that it was, as an economics department goes, it's sort of thought about how economics can apply to everything in the world. I mean, there's probably economists at University of Chicago who think that they can solve astrophysics problems using economics. I mean, it's really this idea of economic imperialism. You really apply economics to every single discipline. And so it wasn't strange in that respect to have an MD, you know, or a medical student like myself, be interested in economics. I do remember this story from a guy named Gary Becker. Becker was a Nobel laureate at the University of Chicago. He's since passed away, and he pioneered something called human capital. It's the way of thinking about how human beings invest in their health and in their education, and the implications of that for a number of economic issues even today. And Gary Becker taught this first course for all economics graduate students, which was incredibly difficult. And at the end of the semester, after the grades were in, there was, by the way, another classmate of mine who ended up doing an MBA and a PhD in economics. Becker is looking at the grades, and he noticed that there was a student who got a B+ in the class who was not enrolled as an economics student. The person was enrolled as a medical student.
Oh my.
And that was not me, by the way. I got a B. It was my friend, Eric Sun. And so Becker emailed Eric Sun, and this is a big deal to get an email from a Nobel laureate saying, you know, I'm a little bit confused. You know, most of the students in this class who are doing their PhDs in economics don't get B+. They get lower than that. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about who you are and you know, might you consider doing your, you know, PhD in economics instead? And, you know, Eric is still a good friend of mine, ended up doing that. So, you know, it was an environment that was very, very welcoming for different things.
That's a funny story. Well, so fast forward, and now you are on the faculty at Harvard Medical School in healthcare policy, and you do really interesting and noteworthy research, as you say, at the intersection of economics and healthcare. But moreover, the reason you're on this show is because of your great podcast, your great new podcast called Freakonomics MD, which is part of the Freakonomics Radio Network, as it's known. And our listeners may be familiar because Freakonomics has existed for years now and is broadcast here on Public Radio Tulsa on Saturday afternoons at 3:00. And Freakonomics MD is part of this network. I think there's about 4 different shows or podcasts that are created through Freakonomics. Tell us a little bit about how you got that started.
I had been on the Freakonomics radio podcast a few times. Once was for the study I did that looked at what happens to patients who are hospitalized with a heart attack when cardiologists are out of town at the national meetings that they go to, like the American Heart Association meeting. It's held one time a year, every year. And a bunch of thousands of cardiologists go to this meeting. And I wondered, well, what happens if you're a patient, you have a heart attack during the dates of this meeting, and you go to the hospital and the cardiologist isn't there, or some cardiologists aren't there. So the first time I was on the Freakonomics podcast was talking about that study and what it meant. And then Stephen Dubner had a series called Bad Medicine. I think it was a 3-part series on kind of the pitfalls of medicine. And I was on that podcast. And I think Stephen was thinking about expanding the reach of the network. And they've already had a couple of shows that had sort of different formats from the main Freakonomics podcast. And I think he realized that there would be an interest in getting something on the books that dealt with health and medicine, because that's an issue that affects all of us, every day.
Yeah. And so lo and behold, in this just recent past year, 2021, you launched Freakonomics MD. And so you are essentially part of the production team there at Freakonomics. And for listeners who may not remember, the original book, Freakonomics, was co-authored by Stephen Dubner, who is the host of the radio show and podcast, and his co-author, Stephen Levitt, who is an economist at the University of Chicago, and in fact was one of your graduate thesis advisors. Tell us a little bit about, I guess, your relationship with Stephen Levitt. And he actually now has his own podcast as part of the Freakonomics Radio Network, but he's only sort of an infrequent contributor to the original Freakonomics radio show.
That's right. So Stephen Levitt, he has a podcast called People I Mostly Admire, which is an interview-based show, and it's quite fun. And, you know, he interviews a lot of different types of people. So I met Levitt probably in 2001 or 2002 when I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago. And I had just finished up my 2 years of economics coursework and was thinking about who to work with on my thesis. And I remember 2 things. One is I took a course with him, which was about kind of like how to think differently in economics. And the other thing I remember is that one of the first sort of Freakonomics style ideas that I had you know, again, this is like 20 years ago, was to study the impact of Viagra on divorce. And the thought was, you know, this is like 6 or 7 years after Viagra had been introduced into the market. And Viagra could do two things. One is for men who were having difficulty being intimate with their wives, it could increase the value of marriage because it allowed them to do so. And that could stabilize marriages. But it could do something else as well. It could allow for men to consider options outside of their marriages. And that would be destabilizing to the marriage. And so it was sort of this open economic question that I thought was, well, does Viagra lead to more divorce or does it strengthen marriages? And I'd kind of got some preliminary evidence that suggested that it you know, it might be destabilizing, but it just didn't kind of fully pass muster with me. So I kind of let that project go. I've always thought about going back to it, but I just never had the time. But that was sort of the first project that I ever discussed with Levitt, and I think probably got me on his radar.
It really does sound like a Freakonomics kind of a study. You're listening You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Bapu Jena. He is the Ruth Newhouse Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School. He's also host of the terrific new podcast called Freakonomics MD, which you can listen to anywhere you get podcasts. And Freakonomics MD, as Dr. Jena stated, is really a podcast about the intersection of economics and health, because he is both an economist and a medical doctor. And Bapu, you have a pretty impressive production, if you will, of research. I mean, you spend, it seems like, most of your time doing research. And you have, over the years, done some pretty noteworthy studies. And an area that you've had some great deal of focus on is our gender differences in healthcare. And that is essentially differences, for example, in male and female physicians. You know, now slightly more than half of all U.S. medical students are female. It took, you know, it took us many years to get to that kind of parity. And still many of the specialties are still more male-dominated, although there are now female-dominated specialties, I should point out. But you find that there are differences both in salary amongst male and female physicians. But another study that you looked at that got a lot of press attention showed that patients of female physicians had potentially lower readmission rates to hospital. I guess I'd love to give you the platform to just sort of comment on those sorts of findings.
You know, I think everybody knows that across all industries, really, probably all industries, women get paid less than men. One of the questions that always comes up that economists raise and you know, people who are skeptical of the gender gap also raise is, you know, how much of the difference of that gender wage gap stems from decisions that differ between men and women about flexible work schedules versus, you know, reflect actual discrimination or bias in the workplace. So take medicine, for example. The surgical fields like orthopedics, neurosurgery, they tend to pay more than fields like internal medicine that I'm in. But they also tend to be very inflexible from a work perspective. And so, you know, if women in general are more likely to value flexible work schedules, then you would observe them to get paid less on average than men because of the specialties that men and women sort into. And that's a common refrain that I hear as someone who works on these issues. But that doesn't tell the whole story. What I think is quite interesting, and this is the work that we've shown, is that even if you look at men and women in the same specialty, and you account for all of the things that we think affect the way that doctors get paid. So if you're in an academic medical center, it's about how many patients you see, what kind of procedures you perform, how much clinical revenue you bring into the hospital, whether you have grants from the federal government, whether you publish a lot of scientific papers, whether you run clinical trials. I mean, these are all the metrics that you'd be familiar with, John, as being things that could impact promotion and salaries in hospitals. Whereas take another field like journalism, right? Like how would you measure the output of two different journalists so as to compare whether or not a male and female journalist are getting paid similar or different amounts, you know, but recognizing that there could be productivity differences between the two. In medicine, it's kind of cut and dry. We know exactly what goes into that earnings equation, if you will. And we can account for those factors. And we see that there's still about a 20% difference in income between men and women. So I kind of view medicine as it's being important in its own right because, you know, because I'm a physician, but it also is sort of a laboratory case for understanding, well, is it really about flexibility that's driving this wage gap? Yeah, it may be in some areas, but certainly in medicine, it doesn't seem to be about that. It's something else.
So interesting. Well, so another sort of demographic factor you look at is the age of physicians and how a physician's age can affect outcomes for patients, especially elderly patients in hospitals in the United States. And you did a study that looked at this. What did you find?
Yeah, so where we were interested in trying to understand is like whether or not older doctors have better or worse outcomes than younger doctors. And, you know, patients might think when they see a doctor, they want a doctor with gray hair or they maybe want a young doctor. An older doctor certainly is going to have more experience with patients, probably seen more diseases, more rare diseases, have more familiarity with different treatments. All those things might point to better outcomes for their patients. On the flip side, though, as you recall and I recall, both of us probably a long time ago, when you're training to be a doctor, that intense period called residency, it's a lot of work, you know, 80 to 100 hours, depending on when you train. And so it's quite possible that when you finish training, when you finish residency, you're about as sharp as you're ever going to be. And, you know I feel that way. When I finished residency, I felt about as good as a doctor as I've ever felt, because that's all I was doing, you know, spending 80 hours a week in the hospital. How could you not be good at anything that you did if you spend that much time doing it? And what we see is if you look at patients who are hospitalized with a medical condition like pneumonia or heart failure or infection, something like that, patients who are treated by younger doctors actually have lower mortality rates than patients who are treated in the same hospital by older doctors. So it does suggest that the outcomes of patients do get worse as the age of the doctor who is treating them gets larger.
So much for gray hair, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I will say, though, that, you know, the one place where that relationship does not seem to hold is doctors who see a lot of patients. So if you're an older doctor and you're very active clinically, you seem to not have this penalty that comes with age. But if you're an older doctor who doesn't see that many patients clinically, you are likely to have worse outcomes than a younger doctor.
Okay, I want to touch on a recent episode of your podcast, and it was titled, When is a Natural Disaster Good for Your Health? You highlighted the work of a couple of economists who you highlight this in a number of episodes, the idea of a so-called natural experiment, which is really quite interesting because, as you point out, sort of across numerous episodes, it's very hard to set up ethical experiments where you essentially would deprive one cohort or one study arm of something that, you know, is pretty accepted as a standard of care, if you will, or a standard economic condition or something like that. So Katrina represented this opportunity for these researchers to look at the health of folks who were affected by the hurricane and kind of how they wound up, many of whom were displaced by the hurricane and wound up in other locales. But what really was compelling, I thought, in that episode was you had an interview with a guy called Donald Berwick, who is pretty famous in healthcare circles as the founder of something called the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. And I thought it was very cogent, the discussion that you had with him about what we call social determinants of health. And I guess, you know, you sort of summarized the episode by saying, you know, you sort of see the world in a way similar to Don Berwick. And I guess I was wondering if, for our listeners' sake, you could summarize that here. And really, what are social determinants of health and what kind of impact do they have on, say, longevity as the perhaps most straightforward indicator of health?
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about social determinants of health, and there's people who spend a lot more time thinking about these issues than I do, is it's really factors like education, income, employment, perhaps certain cultural factors, factors that are built into society that impact health, longevity. And they create diseases. They make diseases worse. They make the ability of patients to get good care worse. All of those things contribute. The reason that we had that I had Don Berwick on the show talking about this issue of how does where you live matter for your health, which was what was exemplified by this Hurricane Katrina study, which showed that when Hurricane Katrina hit, people who lived in New Orleans prior to Katrina ended up moving to other places of the country. And it turns out that they ended up moving to places that had better health and longevity outcomes. And so Katrina, as disastrous as it was, and, you know, recognizing that it killed people really, really in the immediate aftermath of the storm, on net, actually led to more lives being saved in New Orleans because people who were living in New Orleans moved to parts of the country where healthcare was better and the communities had longer life expectancy. So this sort of weird way to show that where you live matters for your health. And Don has made this point in a number of different ways and very forcefully both as an academic and also as a government bureaucrat. He ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and ran for governor in Massachusetts. And, you know, he's got a lot of experience as a doctor, as a policymaker, and you know, I think delivers a story about the importance of factors that, you know, involve where you live in your health in a way that's, you know, hard for most people to articulate.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Bapu Jena, who is the Ruth Newhouse Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School. He's also a host of a new podcast called Freakonomics MD, which you can hear anywhere you listen to podcasts. Here at Public Radio Tulsa, of course, we air the parent show, Freakonomics, the radio show. That's at 3 o'clock on Saturdays here on KWGS. And Bapu, I wanted to hearken back to something you mentioned earlier, which was, I guess, perhaps one of your more famous studies, because it was interesting in and of itself, but also because Freakonomics originally highlighted it, which was about this question of what happens to patients that have heart attacks when the national cardiology meetings are going on. And you sort of tease us with that. So what actually happens? Do patients who have heart attacks during these national meetings wind up doing worse, or do they sort of do about the same?
They actually end up doing better, which is a surprising thing.
Yeah.
So I remember being in the hospital as a resident. I was in training, and it happened to be around the time of one of these major meetings. And at the hospital, the cardiac care unit that I was rotating through, it felt a little bit light in terms of senior staffing. And, you know, I just said, oh, that's interesting. I had this observation I had. And then it made me wonder, well, you know, what happens to patients who have these acute cardiovascular emergencies during the dates of these meetings? Do they get worse care, different care? And so my instinct was that if I was going to see anything, I thought that they would get worse outcomes, have worse outcomes because they received less care. But it turns out they actually did better. And it's a little bit of a puzzle as to why they do better, but I can say two things. One is this is something that's absolutely related to the different composition of cardiologists that are there in the hospital. And this is a good natural experiment. Patients don't choose to have heart attacks on any given day, first of all. And they certainly don't choose to have heart attacks on a day when the cardiology convention is happening nationally because they don't know when that is. So it really is a natural experiment where patients who have heart attacks are effectively randomized by chance, by nature, to these two different scenarios where they have, you know, the normal staffing of cardiologists versus a different staffing of cardiologists because many of the senior ones are perhaps at these conventions that they go to every year. The second thing that we saw was that there seems to be a signal of less intensive procedures being performed. So there's one common procedure that's performed in people who have heart attacks, which is stenting of the blood vessels that supply the heart. And we found that that procedure happened about, let's say 20 to 30% less often during the dates of these meetings. So there's some indication that the type of care was changing, perhaps moving towards less intensive forms of care during those dates. And that might have actually been better for patients, sort of this less is more idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's so compelling for so many reasons. And of course, I'm sure it probably didn't make cardiologists, the senior cardiologists, too happy to know that somehow, at least in this way you looked at it, that patients were somehow doing better with less. I mean, obviously, in American medicine, you know, more is always sort of seems to be on the menu. But in a similar way, I couldn't resist asking you about this because it was so interesting and it's sort of almost similar methodology. I guess when the NRA, the National Rifle Association, held its national convention, it led you and a fellow researcher to ask the question, well, is there actually less gun violence occurring during the NRA national convention? And I guess I'm wondering if you could share what you found.
Yeah, it's a similar kind of idea. You know, the conventions are pretty large. They probably attract some, you know, 80,000 or more people every year. They happen in different parts of the country at different times of the year. So we thought, like, you know, if there's a bunch of individuals who are, you know, gun enthusiasts who go to the conventions or the venues that individuals might use are shut down more often during the dates of these conventions. You know, let's say that, you know, you go to a place where the owner of the gun range has gone to the convention. Maybe the range is closed for that weekend or something like that, or that week. So you can imagine that there's a variety of ways in which gun use during the dates of the convention might fall. And so we hypothesized that we might see reductions in gun injuries because of less use. Now there's an alternative view, which is that, you know, the individuals who are attending these conventions are, you know, perhaps very skilled users of guns. And for them, the risks of injury might be, you know, low because they're skilled at what they do. It's like, I'm not a skilled snowboarder. So if I go snowboarding, you better believe I'm going to get injured. But a professional who does this all the time probably is not going to get injured. Same idea. But, you know, what we found was that there was a reduction in injuries. So what that means is that even among, you know, highly skilled or presumably highly skilled users of firearms, just the virtue of having one and using one at any point, there's always some possible, you know, probability of injury that's positive. And, you know, that's why we see a reduction when there's a period when the guns are less likely to be used, which is when these meetings are occurring.
Interesting. Very interesting. So I want to conclude by asking you about one more of your recent Freakonomics MD podcast episodes. And it was really quite entertaining and informative, which I guess is the sweet spot. But you called it the most unique, excellent, and promising episode. Essentially, the theme of the show was you were showing that studies that had been conducted, research studies conducted by men that were published in scientific journals, and this was actually studied, were more likely to include what you call hyperbolic terms, groundbreaking, unique, wide-ranging, systemic, you know, sort of adjectives and words with more oomph in them than studies perhaps authored or co-authored by female investigators. And I guess, how did you get interested in that? And you know, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I have worked on issues related to pay differences and promotion differences between men and women. And one of the issues that sometimes comes up is, are there differences between men and women in negotiation or how they promote themselves in the workplace? And it's a hard question to study. I mean, you could try and survey men and women and try to figure out something about those differences in negotiation or how they promote themselves within, you know, amongst their peers and supervisors. We sort of took a more like a big data way to look at this question. So we looked at about 5 million different scientific abstracts. These are scientific studies that researchers publish in journals, you know, scientific journals. And we looked at the abstracts and the words and the language used in those abstracts. And what you see is that among studies that are of similar quality, you know, that have been similarly cited by other studies. So it's a measure of the quality of the study. The studies published in the same prestigious journals. So again, another measure of the quality of the study. What we see is that articles in which the scientific team was led by men, they're about 10% more likely to use terms like novel and groundbreaking. You know, for example, a team might say, we identify a novel pathway that links, you know, protein complex A, which is unique, to protein complex B, which is also unique, you know, further suggesting that an important breakthrough has occurred, you know, something like that. Men are more likely to use that kind of language than women are, even if you're looking at studies that are of similar innovative nature.
It's just interesting. Well, you can learn all kinds of things, really, by listening to the Freakonomics MD podcast. I highly encourage it. It's a wonderful listen. Each episode comes in at under 30 minutes. It's hosted by my guest today, Dr. Bapu Jena, who is the Ruth Neuhaus Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School. In addition to hosting the Freakonomics MD podcast, Bapu Jena, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bapu Jena is a physician and economist at Harvard Medical School. He's also the host of the Freakonomics MD podcast. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.